Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love from Vodka O'Clock Podcast and AmberUnmasked.com. Right now, I've got a brand new thing to talk about. I've launched a Patreon over at patreon.com/AmberUnmasked, and what that means is that you can sponsor the show and the website per creation. So for as little as $1 per creation, you would, for example, if I put up a podcast episode like this one and I put that as a Patreon-specific thing, then that means that you would be willing to pay a dollar, like a tip. It's basically an online tip system. So that's brand new, and if you have any questions, you can find me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber, and I will try to answer your questions. I took care of some basic information at the website, and it's a sticky post, so you can always go and reference that. Today, my guest is Tess Kraft. She's joining the show for the first time. So just a reminder that we are labeled as an explicit website and podcast. So Tess and I are willing to talk about anything because we get along that way. So you never know what's going to come up. But we're going to talk about her experiences in the music and entertainment industry, the world of steampunk, and what it's like for her to live with all of those things, all while having a painful illness. So Tess, hey, welcome to Vodka O'Clock.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, if people are not familiar with you, if they haven't bumped into you at a convention, let's just get some background information. Because I know you through comic conventions and steampunk conventions and that sort of thing, but your day job is completely different. So what is that?
I run the box office at a mid-sized concert venue. So it's working in music and with comedians and other widely varied performers from the start of the process of where the show is announced all the way through getting every patron in the door. So it's one way technical and in another way very much get the rock star the cup of coffee he wants, because otherwise he'll have a hissy fit kind of thing.
So you have to take a sort of combination of mommy, boss, and servant role on a daily basis.
Pretty much. Luckily, some of our other staff deals with the more, you know, servant intensive stuff. But if there's somebody who has to be the one to call the police when security staff is busy breaking up some kind of brawl, I end up doing it.
Okay. So was that something that you were specifically looking to get into? Like you just gravitated towards entertainment and wanted to be in that field somehow? Or was it just like you landed there?
Oh, not even a little. I completely landed there. I originally was in social work for almost a decade, and that actually is a big part of where my illness became a problem for me professionally. And I have since had to move to an industry that is far less 9-to-5 specific and that has a little more flexibility than a traditional, you know, social work like DHS position.
So then you found the flexibility that you needed, but what was it like? If you're willing to talk about your condition and name it.
Absolutely. I was diagnosed in 2009 with what's called fibromyalgia. It is a partially autoimmune disorder, partially central nervous system disorder, where the pain response process in your muscles goes on overdrive. And even light pressure can cause severe pain. It's based on the idea that your nerves start firing with pain responses, though there's no painful stimulus. So aching muscles, sore points all over your body. It also includes sleep disturbances, extreme fatigue. It's been associated with reproductive problems because it has a strong impact on how your adrenal glands operate, because if you spend all your time in like constant fight or flight, I'm in pain, stimulus, weather, regardless of situation, essentially your adrenals crap out. And it's not as well understood as some of the other, you know, like rheumatologic disorders and such that affect a similar population, being about 80% women, because it's more of a diagnosis of elimination as opposed to, oh, we have a test. Oh, now we know what it is.
Okay. The only time I can recall looking it up, it was like you had to meet, like, there were 12 spots of pain or something that had to somehow impact your life or something like that. Like, that was the best that they could do.
Yeah, you have to have 11 of 16 pressure points. You also had to have been experiencing that for 6 months or more on both sides of your body, and had to have other, you know, fatigue, sleep disturbance, etc., because the symptoms are similar to things like Lyme disease and chronic fatigue syndrome and rheumatoid arthritis. And you really have to cut everything else out first.
How did, what was it what that became the discovery process for you while you were there? Like, take me back to when you're there and you're a social worker and you're going through this daily grind at a desk. Well, was it something that you heard of before, or was this all a complete surprise?
I had heard of it before, but I was not familiar with it in the sense that, you know, it's like you've heard of Lyme disease before, but you're not particularly familiar with it. It's a thing you hear about. After the time I turned 20 or 21, I noticed that in particular, my sleep patterns had changed somewhat dramatically over the years, and figured, oh, well, you know what? It's probably just, you know, working full time and going to school full time. And I'm not sleeping because I'm stressed out. And as time progressed, I found that there began to be a series of painful reproductive problems as well. Oh, it's girl stuff. It's nothing all related. Over the last probably 2 years that I was in social work, I was getting sick all the time. I either couldn't sleep or I slept 12 or 14 hours a day, and was finding that no matter how much sleep I got, I was still exhausted and a lot of muscle aches and pains. So I assumed I had something like mono. Went to my doctor, did some basic testing, and we monitored it for like 18 months. Well, during that 18 months, I'm taking sick days all over the place. Work is still getting done because I was making myself nuts trying to finish all of the projects on my plate. The more stressful my job got, the worse it got. So when we started to connect that it was exacerbated by stress, that helped narrow down some of the options, since by this point it had continued for 6 months, then a year, then a year and a half. And that's when we finally came to the point of, we've tested for everything else. Let's go see a rheumatologist. The rheumatologist that I saw the first time was like, well, maybe, I don't know, do some more tests. At that point, my primary care physician sent me to the University of Michigan, and we went through the same testing process over again, and that's when we came to the official diagnosis.
Did it impact people that were around you at all, either in, you know, in your social life or at the office?
Oh, absolutely. I was calling into conference calls from home. I was remote working for projects. My coworkers started to really resent the fact that I seemed to have a different schedule than they did. Mind you, they weren't seeing the volume of work product. That was only my supervisor. The staff members that reported to me were starting to go a little bit off the rails because they didn't have sufficient guidance. And, you know, that's on me because I was not there. And when it came to really ahead professionally, we had changed organizational leadership and had a new CEO and organizational president come in. And she went on a house clearing rampage.
They always do. I've been through it. Yeah.
And the first thing she looked at was attendance, without consideration of work product, of course. So that became an issue. At this point, I had already disclosed my disability to my supervisor and the project director, and they were both very understanding, but she was having none of it. So ultimately, as the illness became progressively more severe, because since we didn't have a diagnosis at that point, the treatment options were limited. So it became more severe. She got more strict, more severe, more strict, and so on and so forth until she finally insisted that I be let go. At that point, I had already backed away hugely from social commitments with my family, because there are some days where you make the choice of how to spend your spoons, which is, okay, am I going to go to work today? Or am I going to go and do something social today? Or do I simply have enough energy to get up, brush my teeth, wash my face, and put on clean pajamas? There's no way of predicting it. And my personal social life suffered really dramatically. I've managed to hang on to most of the friendships that were through that time, but it got to the point where people weren't even inviting me to like milestone events anymore, because I would get this directly from the person that I would be talking to, be like, wait, you guys had a birthday party for your child? And yeah, we figured you wouldn't come. So I had to make a decision at that point. Am I going to stay in an industry where clearly the stress is causing the illness to become worse? Am I going to try and balance any kind of social life with the fact that some days I get home and all I can manage to do is eat dinner and go to sleep? If I'm keeping social commitments, what comes first, my family or my friends? And I have found that in the years since then, that has had a very cyclical pattern of repeating, improving, declining, etc.
So then, while it seems like you had to make all of these decisions, and it sounds like you were making these decisions like on your own, what sort of community support did you have?
I was very fortunate that I have, first, an incredible primary care physician who has fought tooth and nail for every change in treatment regimen, for every denial from the insurance company about something that isn't covered, or they wanted me to jump through all sorts of hoops for testing. That's been a huge help, because I don't have to be the one then making those phone calls and, you know, appearing before a review board, etc. Professionally, my support work was very limited. I had my immediate supervisor, who was very understanding, but also knew that he wasn't overriding the CEO's decision-making process. My family has been a mix of supportive and, what do you mean you don't look sick? My spouse has been exceptionally supportive, even if he doesn't necessarily understand what the experience is like. You know, this is a guy that gets a cold once a year and that's it. But my friends, even the ones who I haven't seen in 2 years because I haven't had the energy to make the choice between, all right, I'm going to work a convention, or I have work four nights this week. I need to stay home that other time. They've been very understanding of me not coming to things, as well as once I talked publicly about what was going on, I received immediate emails and phone calls and text messages saying, you know, my aunt, my sister, myself, etc., we're all experiencing this same thing. And I found a wealth of information that was directed towards me as far as diet and exercise and non-traditional, sometimes homeopathic remedies, things that I wouldn't necessarily have thought about without making myself insane with research. And sometimes it's just a case of saying, guys, I'm just not up to it. I know I said I would come. I will come to something when I have the energy for it. And they've come to understand that my ability to have a social life really is going to be somewhat unpredictable, particularly in the industry that I'm in now.
Are you happier now that you've made the career switch?
Most of the time, absolutely. I do still miss the actual work of social work. I loved what I did. I had a real passion for it. And it wasn't until I came to the understanding that the constant stress and the long hours and the kind of grinding workload that came along with it was actually making the illness so much worse, and I was having flares all the time. It was very hard for me to look at this, you know, passion that I'd had since I was a little kid to do something that helped people and to realize that it was actually working its way towards killing me. So to have to step away from that, it was very, very challenging.
Has your definition of success changed because of all of this?
Absolutely. I came from a family that has very, very high standards for what success is. You know, it's you're a partner at a law firm, you're a doctor, something usually related to financial success. And here I was, you know, the weirdo who's not in some kind of high capital industry. And then all of a sudden, what do you mean you can't keep a job in your field? Well, what it means is I wasn't able to keep a full-time job at any point until the medication process and understanding and treatment, recognizing symptoms and triggers was actually far enough along. Like, I didn't realize until after I was diagnosed that I had been experiencing flares for at least a decade and that they had become progressively worse over time. So that I have definitely redirected my notion of what is successful. For me, it's, am I happy doing it? Could I walk away from it and not feel bad if it came down to it? Does it allow me to have the time that I want when I have the energy for it? And am I earning enough to survive? That's about all I look for out of successful at this point. You know, I'm with the particular industry that is pretty easy to achieve because you know what? Ultimately, it's concert tickets. It's not whether or not someone keeps their DHS benefits. But it took some adjusting to get to a point where I could accept that, you know, I'm never going to live in the 3,500 square foot home that I grew up in.
Right.
But, you know, I came down to the point where I'll take having some measure of happiness and some measure of being able to accept who I am, what my strengths and limitations are, and not have to worry about, do I have to work 80 hours a week to get where I need to be?
As I said earlier, you and I have some common ground with things like comic books and steampunk, and you know, obviously music is important to you. So what is it that those types of entertainment do for you?
Well, first and foremost, it's always been an escape. If no matter how lousy I may feel, I can still enjoy a movie. I can still read a new graphic novel and have something that's intellectually stimulating as well as interesting, and that puts me outside of my own world for a while. With music, I have expressed I could express all of the emotion in virtually every situation in my life through music. You know, there's a playlist for everything, that from, you know, at complete joy at a wonderful life event to, can I just crawl under my bed and never come back out? You know, that's been a real huge impact on my ability to also take myself out of my own head long enough to recognize that perhaps things are not as bad as they may appear. And particularly with it being that while I'd always been a fan of comic books, I've always been interested in movies, I've always been passionate about music, having come into being part of working conventions or working in the industry was completely by chance and almost literally a result of my fibromyalgia experiences.
So it had something positive come into your life
absolutely.
You might not have known about.
I never would have expected, you know, there I was at 35, out of a professional full-time job for the first time in like a decade, and actually more than a decade. I'd been working in my field, doing what I wanted, and all of a sudden it was, you know, I live in Detroit. The market is very glutted with nonprofit professionals. So it was, okay, well, what do I do next? Knowing that I was going to spend anywhere from 6 to 9 months just finding a treatment regimen that worked, because you have a progression of, like anyone who suffers from mental illness or other, you know, serious illness, that they're going to understand you have a progression of, you try this medication, you try this medication, you step up this dosage, but then you have to ramp back down. It's not a direct path. And sometimes it's one where, wow, we didn't expect that side effect. And, you know, you can't sleep for 2 weeks straight. You know, no one can keep I can't keep a full-time professional schedule with that kind of stuff going on. So I knew I had the opportunity to really concentrate on trying to get the treatment back in place. But I also knew that I was going to have to go back to work before too long. So when I did go back to work, it was completely by chance. I had a friend who asked if I wanted to work at her vendor booth at a steampunk convention. And then I spent the next 18 months traveling all over the country, working and attending conventions, because I had so much fun. The hours are long. The work is physically exhausting. But I always felt better doing that than I did in maybe the last year and a half that I was working in my professional field. Because at the end of the day, you turn off the light and you walk away.
It's definitely not the same kind of stress. It's completely different stress. It's dealing with customers and, you know, making sure that you guys are selling enough. And like you said, the physical demands of a convention are unbelievable. I mean, people might think that, oh, it's all fun, and it's like, oh God, it's so tiring. It's, you know, and shows like the Steampunk World's Fair, those vendor booths don't actually have like a time schedule. It's sort of like a 24-hour convention. You're open when you want to be open. Is it, you know, I know it's very different from, you know, from Comic-Cons, but do you have different experiences based on what kind of show you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. Comic book conventions, as a general rule, they have their very set up and tear down hours. They have very explicit dealer's room hours. And then there, most of the programming goes on outside of that space. If you're talking about science fiction conventions or steampunk conventions, or like I worked a tattoo convention once, those have a much more organic, you can, sometimes you set your hours, sometimes the hours are set, but there's other stuff that goes along with it. For example, like you mentioned Steampunk World's Fair, the traditional dealer's room is open until at least midnight. And if you're vending out of your hotel room, like this is, that is at that show, you might still be open at 3 a.m. It all depends. But comic book conventions seem to have a more specific, rigid structure. And I've worked a little bit of all of them. But I have found that even with it being physically exhausting, with the travel being physically exhausting, you know, I would leave Detroit on a Tuesday or a Wednesday morning, drive to Minneapolis, set up the booth, work the show, in the evenings, be very socially active because that's just kind of what you do at conventions, and work the next day, work the final day, do the teardown, get back in the car, and drive 13 hours back to Detroit. It's completely exhausting, but not in the same sense that my previous field was. I was not emotionally drained or so intensely stressed out that I couldn't function. I was covered in bruises and had driven all over the country, but I was actually having fun, and I didn't realize really how much a stressful, right, like traditional work environment was wearing me down.
Well, it sounds like you also have a good boss in the small business opportunities. You know, you don't have somebody who's just going to ride your ass, and if you say, you know, on this 13-hour trip, hey, I need to stop right now, you know, while you're, you know, commuting together or something. Like, it sounds like you have a really, because you're also friends, and, you know, it's not a boss that is not understanding like the CEO that you had.
Oh, absolutely. I've been very fortunate that for the small handful of vendors that I have worked for, I have had a personal relationship with them before I ever worked for them, and have been able to not only be upfront about, hey, you know what, we're closing and I'm going back to our hotel room and I'm going to bed if I just don't feel up to it. If we're taking that long drive and my entire body is one giant, like, knotted pretzel and I've got to stop for 30 minutes, totally understanding of that because it's not the same kind of industry. And as that progressed into me having the opportunity to work at the venue that I do, same by chance, hey, I need somebody part-time, it fit in the spaces for when I wasn't traveling and was fortunate enough to have a very understanding pair of bosses there as well who said, you know what, if you're having a bad day or if your travel schedule took too much out of you, switch your shift for that day. It's never been an issue. It's not, I don't know if it's just the character of the industry or if it's the particular people that I have worked with, but I find that creative people take a very different approach. Like, it's not the regular 9-to-5, and that's probably a big part of why they're doing it.
I was going to say, it sounds, it's not that there's no business skills. I mean, it's, you know, even when you're a creative type, you have to be a business person. It's just that it's a very different work ethic and work thought processes, especially when you're working for independent vendors like you do. You have people who they're not answering to a gigantic board of trustees. You know, they have their own mission. They have their own ideas. And like you said, it's creative. A lot of creative people. It's amazing to me how the creative people who still need to make a profit sound like they had more charitable thought processes than when you were in an actual charity type of job.
Oh, absolutely. I have found that while I worked with people who were truly good people, who had a genuine interest in the community, all of that interest what seemed to be expended for the job most of the time. When I've worked with independent business owners and people who have made creativity their business, I find that I don't know if it's just that they're working at their own pace, if it's because they're not answering to that board of trustees, but that they've had much more interest in me, the human being, as opposed to me, the employee. And I have wanted to work even harder for those who have made the effort to be, to be a friend, whether it's just I'm going to call you at 2 a.m. when something goes wrong kind of thing. That they've made a greater effort to be understanding and recognize that we're not just the number that our, payroll report lists.
Right. So as women, one of the things that we, we often talk about is experiencing harassment in places like conventions, regardless of the genre, or the workplace, or online. And one of the things that I find remarkable is that even in those settings where sometimes there's a fear, places like steampunk shows and comic book shows and sex-positive sex education shows, total strangers can be like the most odd support group that's just like ad hoc. You don't even know their names, but you're having a problem. And whether you're just in a chair in the lobby or if you're at the bar or whatever it is, somehow there's something about these creative communities that they're these wonderful, heartful moments. And I didn't get those experiences in corporate.
Oh, definitely not. It's hard to explain to people who aren't familiar with the way some of these events are just more organically, that you might meet people whom you've never met before, and suddenly there's a true human connection there. And I think that part of that is that in the creative industries, particularly if you're looking at writers, artists, people who craft, etc., they're looking at the human condition from a very different perspective. It's, I'm fascinated, or I'm intrigued, or I'm interested in your human condition, because that's not only, and not to make it sound self-serving, that's what drives creative experience. That's how can you write a novel about the experience that you heard about if you hadn't sat down and talked to that stranger in the bar that told you the story or what have you. Or you have the experience of, hey, you're like me. You appear to have the same interests, and I can see that you're hurting, you're sad, you're excited. and these very natural, like flowing, dynamic exchanges come out of that. When you're in a corporate environment, you might know that the person in the cube next to you has a daughter who's a Girl Scout and that she's selling cookies, but you don't, for the most part, unless it's a invested relationship, you don't know that they're having trouble at home. You don't know that they're having some kind of illness or other personal problem because we're not supposed to bring it there.
Something that I read on Twitter in the past week, because some of the cool hashtags that I like to see are things like "We need diverse books," or you know, that there's a new one called "Comics Forward," pushing comics forward, that the executive that Boom Studios started. And what these things do regarding our entertainment consumption is they can bring awareness as to things that are big gaping voids, and it's not just about making money in a particular marketplace that hasn't been addressed enough, but it's about giving people connections and characters and storylines and things that are relatable. And I saw this man tweet saying, "Hey, I'm in a wheelchair and I don't like Professor X. I need diverse books, or I need diverse comics." And it's sort of true. Like, you can't just define this an illness and say, "Okay, Tess, you know, I'm going to make a character that has fibromyalgia just for you to relate to it." And it could be completely wrong and not satisfy you in any way. So have you found characters or storylines or movies or anything that really spoke to you that you said, "Yeah, this is totally something that relates to me"?
Yes and no. I tend to find more individual personal interactions that relate more closely, but I do see looking for example at the X-Men universe, seeing that mutants to the outside world, many of them look just like everybody else. But when you learn about their experiences, when you learn about their powers or what they had to go through in the quote unquote human community, that is where you begin to relate. Where someone like a character like Rogue, it's not a direct connection, but I can see why the movie universe Rogue would be interested in going for the cure, because it's something that nobody sees about her, but it's something that she experiences every single day. And having the ability to look at what someone's internal struggle that isn't necessarily reflected by their outward appearance, it reminds you that you can't, whether you're a corporation or another person, you can't judge what someone else is experiencing just by that outward appearance. Just where I can see that the gentleman in the wheelchair doesn't necessarily find Professor X representative of his experience. That it needs to be, I need to see things that reflect people as they are, not just, "Oh, by the way, the character's in a wheelchair." You know, that doesn't necessarily work for me. But I do find that struggle of balancing who you are with whom the world expects you to be, who you are with whom you wish to be, and trying to balance it, all of it together, to something resembling happiness, where that definitely rings through with me.
Have you actually wished for superpowers, like most kids, I think, do? And I think even now, like, we're full-grown adult readers of comics, and we're surrounded by fantastical worlds.
Oh, like, constantly.
You know.
All the time.
All of our entertainment. So, like you said, you know, you understand that Rogue would want the cure, and you know, to me, it seems logical that of course she would. But you know, what a sacrifice that she would have to go through if she took it. But on the other hand, she has a big sacrifice not taking it. So what superpower have you thought of?
Oh, it changes depending on what particular experience I'm having. A lot of times it's, if only I could force choke that person and get away with it. Other times it would be the ability to stall time, or the ability to influence thought, like the kind of usually vampirically associated idea of being able to temporary glamour someone into thinking what you want them to think, seeing what you want them to see, while it would go horribly awry in actual practice. It's tempting to be able to see, all right, you're going to stop being a jackass for 5 minutes, and you're going to go and say something nice to someone else, as opposed to whatever it is they're actually doing at the time.
Right. You talked about being in Detroit, and what comes to mind is something akin to like a demilitarized zone, my life out here in the country. You know, I've read the articles about how people there don't have water, even though there's millions of dollars being put into arenas and corporate worlds and stuff like that. But yet there's just the most unbelievable graveyard of abandoned buildings and everything. So what is, in Detroit, what impact is your city having on you?
I find myself in the position, like many Detroiters, where I both love and loathe the city at the same time. I believe that it has potential. I also know that it has corruption that has rotted away at the foundation for 40 years or more, that its industries are struggling and sometimes failing to catch up with what the rest of the world is doing. But then I remember, whatever the papers may say and whatever kind of, you know, abandoned building porn you want to see on, you know, in someone's photo book, I think about the people. And Detroit, there's a t-shirt that would perfectly describe, it's Detroit hustles harder, that the people who have stayed, the people who have committed to making an effort, who are the ones who are actually spending time in the city and not just to go to those sports arenas, you know, the ones who have their favorite dive bar downtown and live there and invest their time and money there. There's such heart and such commitment to keeping it alive that I can't help but be awed by it. The people who are truly of Detroit, whether they were raised in the city limits or not, they have a passionate dedication to it. It's kind of like New Yorkers, but New Yorkers take New York City for granted a bit, where they're like, yeah, I'm from Brooklyn. Brooklyn's always been here. Brooklyn will always be here. Detroit may not always be here. And that kind of passion that you see, especially like in the boroughs, where you've got people who are, they couldn't wear the fact that they're from Queens as any more of a badge of honor. People in Detroit are very much the same way and dedicated to those creative industries. The Detroit music scene is unbelievable. The independent film scene here is absolutely fantastic. The art, the live theater productions. I mean, you're not going to get something like Theater Bazaar anywhere else in the country. Like, where else are you going to find a crazy circus-themed party for 5,000 people in a historic building in what otherwise seems like the middle of the demilitarized zone that sells out within days of going on sale every year, and that people all over the country talk about. It's there's nowhere quite like it, that's for sure.
With the financial bankruptcy and whatever problems that the city itself is having, that the government's going through there, I remember seeing that they had millions of dollars worth of artwork that they were going to try and sell just to, you know, help put the slightest dent in the problems that they're having there. But it is something that you hear about with music and with all sorts of creative entertainments and stand-up comedy. Like you said, you get to see that. You get to see more of it than the average person.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate in my experiences in my lifetime here in Detroit that I have known the glassblowers and the painters and the sculptors and photographers and filmmakers, musicians, and, you know, a huge broad variety of creative people. And I've seen how hard they work, not only at their craft, but to try and keep that toehold of this, you know, creative currency alive. The idea that if we can build the creative arts and the community arts sector of business here in the city, that there's going to be something that's going to thrive. And, you know, Detroit and I are a lot alike. We start out doing one thing and you find yourself somewhere else completely different, but you're still working hard to try and get wherever it is that you can, even if it wasn't the original destination.
So did you, I know that when I was a kid, every, you know, 5 minutes, I changed my thought about what I wanted to be when I grew up. So when you look back and you think about, you know, when you were, I don't know, maybe 13 or some adolescent, vulnerable time, what would you, now at your age, what would you want to go back and tell yourself now that you had to live through your 20s and half your 30s trying to figure out what was going on with your body?
I think the first thing I would tell myself would be that it's never going to be what you expect. And to not lose sight of the fact that, especially when it comes to professional decisions and who you're going to be when you grow up, which is a process I'm still working on, that it's...
We don't need to grow up, right?
I hope not. I can still be satisfied with what I do and happy with who I am and feel comfortable in my own skin, even if it doesn't look the way that I think it was going to, or that it doesn't match the picture that was put in front of me as an example. Where I have found now in my late 30s that I am way more comfortable with the fact that my tattoos and piercings and crazy purple, pink, and neon yellow streaked hair, working in an industry that is comfortable with my own particular brand of weird, and that understands that no two people's experiences are the same, then I would, no matter how much I loved the emotional reason for being in a community service position or a social service position, I never got to be myself. And when the time came that who I was included this painful, although invisible, debilitating illness, that it was really okay for me to be that that oddball that ran away with the circus and worked the convention circuit for 2 years before working in a local circus, and that the regular respectable industries, as quote unquote, as you might want to call them, are not somewhere that you have to be in order to have a fulfilling life.
I love that you bring up the circus kind of quality and the circus performers and the whole fascination and fantasy of running away, being a, you know, being a lost boy, because it's just, I can, like, the first conversation I think I ever had with my mother about the Renaissance Fair.
That was a fun one on my part.
It was something, and I don't even know if I had ever been to one at that point. I probably had, but I just remember when, like, a family member was talking about, you know, needing work and, you know, was thinking of giving up this sort of bullshit corporate life, or at least, you know, supplementing it on the weekends, and, you know, going and working at the New York Renaissance Fair. And my mother calling it, saying, you might as well just run away with the circus. like that was the most, like, profoundly ludicrous, unbelievable thing. Like, nobody could possibly do this. And I said, I can't even remember when it was, but it was one of these times that I was watching a trapeze artist, and she's doing these great aerial silk things, and then she has a trapeze, and these are the things we do here in New Jersey, by the way. I'm glad to hear, you know, that Detroit and people familiar with Cirque du Soleil are used to this kind of thing, but to me this was, like, mind-blowing. I'm middle-aged and had never seen anything like this in person before. And now we have fitness studios that specialize in aerial fitness. It's fantastic. So I'm like, wow. You know, like, one of my best friends is, like, an acrobat. Like, she has a day job. She's one of these day jobs, but like, on the weekends she can do trapeze things. I'm like, this is awesome. I know circus people. I know burlesque people. Like, what a crazy notion that, you know, those are the things that little kids dream of. Like, they just flying. They just want to do all of these amazing things. You want to have spectacular costumes, and you want everything to look like fun, and you just want to be with your friends and not have it feel like work.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and that exists out there. It's like, so few people have that. And I'm so, you know, like, I'm so jealous that there's that sort of life and people figure it out. Like, I don't know that I could figure it out.
I didn't think I ever could. And I worked at the Michigan Renaissance Festival for 16 years, and all of those years, during those 8 weeks of that fair, I was working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I was excited to be there on the weekends. It just took me, you know, those 14 of those 16 years to figure out that perhaps that kind of industry with other people who are outside the traditional mainstream and the traditional definition of success, who may or may not be struggling with their own problems or, in many cases, their own demons, and that for it to show that you can still earn a living and still be a giving and productive person doing something that everybody thinks is a total joke.
Right. It's rewarding to bring joy.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that when it comes to creating, because I write and, you know, and I do the podcast and I model and stuff, but do you have your own creative outlets?
I don't write or perform, but I find that I can express my creativity through the costumes that I assemble when I'm going to events, through the expression of personality that I exercise over my body.
And I'm so jealous of, because I've never had have the opportunity to have a job where I could do that. Like, I got in trouble at my last job for my hair color.
Yeah, I didn't do the crazy hair color until the last, like, 2 years. I had some crazy haircuts, but, and I had all of my tattoos are in somewhere where they can be covered for professional purposes.
Right.
And I can't tell you how liberating it is to be able to, you know, at approaching 40, to be able to do whatever I want, as long as I'm getting my job done, and my job is still one that I would call a quote-unquote grown-up job. It has traditional responsibilities, and I still manage personnel and so on and so forth. But if I could show up literally with pink and purple and neon yellow in my hair, and no one even so much as bats an eyelash.
No, not at all.
And
you know, and I've seen you in the, you know, you've got these glorious, amazing corsets and, you know, cool skirts and fishnets and, you know, half your head shaved or whatever. It's, you know, when I can remember walking into the, when you were helping vend at the hat booth.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the setting of it, because like we were trying to explain, is different when people at shows like the Steampunk World's Fair, they sort of make their hotel rooms into little boutiques.
Right.
And you guys had it set up, and it was so spectacular, and there's just texture and color and smiles, and these are things that you don't get in an office.
Right.
At least no office I've ever been in.
And, you know, while I'm not someone who produces a creative product like the writers and artists and craftspersons and musicians that I work with, I still get the benefit of being able to express myself and see them express themselves and turn that into a successful, sometimes able to support themselves solely on it, but into a successful professional enterprise. And I wouldn't have thought, if I had asked myself 25 years ago, that you could really make a living in the creative industries. And now, knowing not only can you make a living doing it, you can be happy and satisfied in that industry, making that successful living and doing it your way, and with, and in more than just my own case, whether it's struggling with mental illness or a physical disability or some other kind of personal health or well-being challenge, it pretty much makes you want to look back at all those years and be like, you know what, conformity, you can go fuck yourself.
I agree.
It only took me till almost 40 to figure that out. I'm still trying to explain it to my mom. She hasn't quite gotten that yet, but.
Yeah. Well, they want what's best for us. They want us, you know, to be stable.
Oh, yeah. And my family is exceedingly normal. Like, uh-huh. Exceptionally normal. They're almost weird. They're so normal.
So then what is it like when Tess goes home with purple hair at Thanksgiving?
My family has learned that.
They just don't know.
They know not to expect anything in particular, but they've also learned that if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. So for the most part, it gets kind of like deer in headlights stares, and that's so creative. Or when I talk about my involvement in steampunk or comic books, or when I talk about my job and it's weird hours and it's bizarre people, and most of the time they just say, oh, that sounds so interesting, which of course we all know interesting is polite for weird, but
And, you know, weird is okay. Weird works for me.
Well, I figure, same here. It took me forever to figure it out, but it does now. I'm just hoping that one of these days I'll be successful enough that I can transition to eccentric.
Oh, see, I think you have to be 50.
Oh, I think you just have to be wealthy.
Oh, that too. I would love to, yes, I would love to add that to my business card.
If I hadn't had the opportunities in the, you know, in the arts and in creative industry that I've had, I don't know how much longer I would have even managed in social services, considering what the nature of my health has been. And to be able to recognize that I wasn't going to find myself trapped without any hope of standing on my own 2 feet, that it was very liberating for me to know that, you know what, maybe I don't have to look at the rest of my life as a sentence of days where I can't get out of bed. I can look at it as, I've got the energy today, I've got the energy right now, I'm going to make the best of it while I can. At least that's what I tell myself. It doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, well, it's, you sound like you have a far better attitude than I would.
Oh, it's a work in progress, believe me. I have days where I'm like, you know what, I can't even picture what 60 is going to look like. Like, where am I going to be at that point? Am I going to be able to continue to work full time? Am I going to have to, what am I going to have to come to accept about myself now? But in the meantime, I'm going to do what I can to work hard at it and enjoy it, because I'm fortunate enough that I get to be myself doing what I'm doing. And not a lot of people who struggle with the same kind of invisible but visible problems, they don't have the luxury of being in an industry that allows them to sometimes set their own schedule or work from home, or and there are days where, you know, I get home from a show at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then I have to be back there at 9:30, where I'm just thinking, oh my God, I couldn't possibly have enough energy or the hours in the day. But I would rather do that feeling comfortable in my own skin than grind myself into nothing on that, you know, through that corporate gristmill anymore.
That's good. And it's important, I think, that you actually discovered these things at a relatively young age, where, you know, you're not 60 now and looking back and going, oh Jesus, I wasted 40 years being stifled.
Yeah, I know that I'm fortunate in that, and I think that the fibromyalgia pushed me to that realization sooner than I would have otherwise, and I've got to look at that as like a silver lining of sorts. As difficult as the experience has been, and as many days as I feel absolutely awful, I'm not in a position where I'm going to look back and I'm going to regret that I literally pushed myself closer to death through not taking proper care of myself by letting this kind of, you know, societal notion that, you know, birth, school, work, death is the way that everyone should do things. No, I'm happy with my little circus instead. Thank you.
Well, before I let you go, do you have any like charities or organizations or things that have helped you, or that you normally throw support to, get recommendations by, in order for you to get to where you have with the fibro and just in life, things that you found are helpful for you?
As far as the fibro goes, that's been more of a direct one-to-one community support model for me. You know, I'm not involved in like a national organization, but.
Right. You said that you have a good doctor. And so
absolutely.
You know,
I'm very fortunate for that. But I do find that there are organizations that I have had wonderful support for elsewhere in my life. Planned Parenthood is one that I am always looking to support, because they provide the largest amount of free or low cost medical care to women between 16 and 29. And, the American Cancer Society, they're very established names, but, at different points in my life, you know, my mom is a breast cancer survivor, and the folks from American Cancer Society went to a huge extent of offering family support and looking at the patient as a whole person and how their life affects them, which that's a model that I've been fortunate that my physician looks at as well, that you are not your illness. Your family is experiencing this with you. So I've always gone out of the way to try and support their work, because their philosophy helped me with my particular journey.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and this, you know, intimate look at your life. I appreciate that.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show, and I've been delighted to do it.
Do you have any like online places that, you know, if people follow you through social media or anything like that, that you care to share?
No, I tend to keep that stuff pretty personal.
Okay.
Mostly because it gets to be unmanageable otherwise.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't have a creative persona or I'm not producing content per se. So it's mostly just, you know, me and my Facebook page just kind of hanging out.
Okay. Well, hopefully then as people get to know you at the 2015 convention circuit, you'll run into even more people. You know, you get to see millions of them a year.
Oh, I absolutely do. And they're always fascinating.
Cool. Well, Tess, my weirdness honors your weirdness.
Well, thank you. My weirdness is honored by your weirdness.
You guys can, of course, follow me, because I'm on every bit of social media there is, pretty much. Except for those things that the kids are using, like Snapchat apparently has shows now. I was like, I thought Snapchat was for porn. But anyway, mostly on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber. Everything else is at amberonmath.com. And don't forget that you can help me out if you appreciate the show and the website and the content that I provide. There's a new Patreon page. It's patreon.com/amberonmath. So thank you so much for listening, and until next time, cheers.